This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, the devastation in Gaza. We hear how ordinary people are struggling to survive. And Cuba celebrates the 50th anniversary of the revolution. But Cubans face tough economic times, and many have to moonlight to make ends meet.
Everybody is doing something outside of their job to make a little money. Because if we don't, we'll die of hunger. We won't have enough to eat.
Plus, we go to Mexico, the birthplace of chocolate, to taste a traditional hot drink called chocolate atole.
Here we have in front of us have cacao, cinnamon, almonds, and sugar. This is the flavor I learned from my grandma.
First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Israel's assault on Gaza has left hundreds dead, many of them civilians. The International Red Cross has declared the situation in Gaza a humanitarian crisis. Israel has barred all foreign journalists from entering the Gaza Strip. But we caught up with reporter Daniel Estrin, who's been on the Israeli-Gaza border. Daniel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Can you give us some sense of what's happening on the ground in Gaza?
Conditions are really worsening by the minute. You know, ordinary civilians there have been coping with a lot of challenges even before this latest military action. For about the past year and a half, ever since Hamas took over the Gaza Strip by force. But really, what's going on now is that there are severe shortages. There's no electricity in many parts of Gaza. They're very low on industrial fuel, so the power plant there has been shut down. There's very little running water because the pumps depend on electricity, and the electricity has been shut down in many parts of Gaza. So there's a shortage of drinking water. The sewage system is barely functioning. Food is in short supply in some areas. Although Israel has allowed in more than 500 aid trucks into Gaza, it's really hard to get that food out to people around Gaza because of the fighting, because it's really hard to coordinate with the Israeli military.
Do you have some sense of just how drastic it is for people with these shortages?
Well, people aren't starving, fortunately. People have saved up and stocked up on food in their houses. But for the poorest Palestinians, it's very tough because they depend on food given out by the UN, and that food had been stopped for a number of days. It recently resumed.
And I know that Israel is not allowing reporters like yourself into Gaza. So how are you communicating with people there? How are you finding out what's really happening on the ground?
I'm making a ton of phone calls to people in Gaza, and it's really difficult because the only Palestinian cell phone company has said that its infrastructure was really damaged by the military operation a few days ago. And, you know, I find myself hours on the phone trying to get in touch with people, and the cell phone call just does not go through.
But sometimes you are getting through?
I do sometimes get through, that's correct.
Who are you able to connect with? I mean, who have you been able to connect with, and what are they telling you?
Actually, just about 5 minutes ago, I managed to get through to one man named Hassan. He's a reporter with a Palestinian newspaper. He told me that he's just miserable. He's on the fifth floor of a tall building. He and his wife have three kids, and he said the other day they found a letter that his son had written that made him cry for a half an hour. His son wrote, "Dear Mom and Dad, I know I'm going to die. Forgive me for all the things that I did wrong. And please bury me next to my grandfather." And this is a teenage son writing something like this that, I mean, it just is heart-wrenching to hear.
Daniel, Israel's under a lot of international pressure to back off of its assault on Gaza. But the Israeli government says it has to do this to defend itself against the rocket attacks that started this whole conflict. You've been on the ground in Israel. You're there now. What is the situation really like for Israeli citizens day in and day out as these rockets continue to fire?
Yeah, well, Israelis say that it's really an unbearable situation in the southern towns that are surrounding the Gaza Strip. Rockets fall on a daily basis, and that's actually been happening for the past 8 years, since 2001. You know, for them, it's a nightmare. You can be in the shower in the morning and you can hear a siren and have to run and seek cover. You could be sleeping and hear a siren. It really, really just paralyzes cities along the Gaza Strip. In the past couple of weeks, these rockets that Hamas has been shooting into Israel have landed deeper and deeper into Israel. So the other day I was in Sderot, it's a town on the border, and I was eating a falafel on the sidewalk, and you know, the streets are pretty bare there, and all of a sudden I heard the code red siren, which is what the army does to alert you when a missile is about to land. All of a sudden, everyone jumped to their feet, entered the falafel stand. I ran with them, and about 10 seconds later, we heard a boom, and the missile had landed, and then everyone went back. And that's a normal day for them.
Mm-hmm. So it's really an untenable situation, a terrible humanitarian crisis on the Gaza side, and certainly for Israelis, it's a lot of psychological trauma.
Yeah, it's both psychological trauma and many people have been killed and injured by these missiles.
All right, Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Daniel Estrin is a reporter based in Israel.
Cuba marked the 50th anniversary of its revolution on New Year's Day. Many Cubans are proud of their education and healthcare systems, but they're fed up with never having enough money. In Cuba, only two forms of free enterprise are allowed. You can rent a room in your house, and you can have a small restaurant on your terrace. But these businesses are strictly regulated and taxed at more than 80%. So some Cubans are skirting the government and trying to make a little extra money on the side, or a la izquierda, as Cubans say. As part of our series on Cuba, Amelia de Souza reports from Trinidad. The names of the people in her story have been changed to protect their identities.
Herman Pena is in his backyard with a couple of friends lifting weights. Like most things in Cuba, gym equipment is hard to find, so Pena and his friends have gotten pretty creative at improvising. Some of them drag over a heavy set of rusted, round metal plates, which they stack onto a bar.
These are just hunks of iron, really, the gears from big trucks. We use them to lift weights, because exercise is good for our health.
What Peña is afraid to say in the microphone is that it's also good for his wallet. He's running this makeshift gym as a small, illegal business. As one of the guys labors to bench press about 200 pounds in car gears, another counts his repetitions using pebbles on the ground. The guy on the bench says he's going to do a set of 20, but he only makes it to 17. Peña charges 20 Cuban pesos per month, less than a dollar, to use this equipment. He's got about 10 regular customers, all friends in the neighborhood. Peña, like all Cubans, gets a monthly government stipend of about $15. He also gets a monthly ration book for basic food, and he doesn't have to pay rent. In his day job, he's a jack of all trades.
Sometimes I work in construction, sometimes I'm a cook or a carpenter, whatever I need to make a living. I've run this place in my house for a few years. But because working conditions here are so bad...
By working conditions, he means that what the government pays him isn't enough to get by, hence his backyard business. But other people make their illegal money right on the street. This tourist has just driven into Trinidad. He rolls down the window to ask a guy on the street where he can find a hotel. Jesus Romero has been working this corner at the entrance to town for years. He works as a jinetero, which is Cuban slang for a guy who hunts for tourists. He waits for tourists to ask for directions, then offers to work for them as a guide. Romero crouches in the back seat to avoid being seen by police, and at the same time points out the local tourist attractions, the church, the town square. It's illegal for him to be talking to tourists, much less riding in their car. But he does it to compensate for the meager government salary he earns working as a school teacher.
I make only a little money, about 300 Cuban pesos, which is about 15 convertible pesos.
Convertible pesos, that's Cuba's second currency. The first, of course, is the Cuban peso, which is worth next to nothing. The convertible peso, or CUC, is only for tourists. It's pegged to the U.S. dollar and is designed to generate profits from tourism for the government. It's illegal for Cubans to have CUCs, but tour guides like Romero are specialists at working foreigners for CUC tips, which they then convert on the black market into Cuban pesos.
I have to invent ways to make money without stealing. That's why I go with tourists. I help them find a place to sleep, or bring them to a family restaurant, or take them horseback riding.
He never asks for money, but instead waits patiently for a tip at the end of his services. Most tourists are pretty generous. On a good day, he can make $10, nearly what he makes in a month at his teaching job.
Everybody is doing something outside of their job to make a little money, because if we don't, we'll die of hunger. We won't have enough to eat.
At an intersection, a policeman stops the car and asks Romero where he's going. Romero says he's just helping these people who got lost find their way back to their hotel. The policeman stares at him, then waves the car on. This time, Romero was lucky.
Oh boy, I am running a big risk here, too big. Because if the police see me, they can arrest me. I can get up to 4 years behind bars.
And the more money you make, the bigger the crime. Roberto Alvarez knows. He used to take tourists on illegal scuba diving trips for $50 a pop, until he was caught.
They'll take you to this place without windows. You don't know if it's night or day. They don't give you enough to eat. They wake you up when you're sleeping in your cell at 2 in the morning to interrogate you. They want to know who you are with, where, when. They hit you to make you talk. They attack you with a dog with no teeth, just to scare you.
After his ordeal in the jail, Alvarez was sentenced to 4 years of house arrest, a common punishment for petty crimes. But he says if given the chance, he'll go back to the illegal scuba diving business, because he says to survive in Cuba with a family, you've got to work a la izquierda, or on the side. For the World Vision Report, I'm Amelia De Souza in Trinidad, Cuba.
There's a slideshow to go along with this story. You can find it on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And you can read Amelia's blog there. Coming up, meltdown in Mexico, how the global financial crisis is playing out south of the border. Stay with us on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. No one needs to be reminded that our economy is in serious trouble. The same can be said for economies all over the world, including our southern neighbor. Mexico has been hit with a double whammy. Fewer dollars are being sent back home by immigrants whose work has dried up here in the U.S. And when the global markets fell in September, panicky international investors rushed to pull money out of the Mexican market, even though the Mexican economy has been strong and stable for years. Dan Gretsch covered that story for the public radio show Marketplace. He joins us from Miami.
When you have a huge demand of tens of billions of dollars of investors saying, I want to sell my pesos and buy dollars, you have a huge demand for dollars and a cratered demand for pesos in Mexico, and you get a devaluation. What a devaluation is the value of the peso weakens. It takes more pesos to buy the same number of dollars. And suddenly, in a matter of hours, something that was $10 is now $14. And that's what happened to Mexico on October 10th.
So what's the trickle-down effect, starting with the Mexican government and economy and Mexican corporations?
Let's take you back to October 10th. Okay, so the day begins and the peso is somewhere between 10 and 11 pesos to the one U.S. dollar. And that's where it had been for the last 5 years. For the last 5 years, the Mexican peso has been incredibly, historically stable compared to the dollar. And that is a huge credit to the good economic stewardship of the Mexican government. They've paid down their debts. They've had a balanced budget. The economy has been growing. And there's been a huge amount of confidence in the Mexican economy. The other thing that's happened in an accelerated way in the last decade is Mexican companies like Cemex, the cement maker, like America Mobil, which is Carlos Slim's cell phone and telephone company, have become huge international giants. Mexico was a huge success story, and investors had been richly rewarded over the last decade for investing in the Mexican stock market. But then on October 10th, and there's no reason why it had to be October 10th, this is actually 100% an issue of panic and investor sentiment. It has nothing to do with any underlying reality in the Mexican economy. On October 10th, people just started freaking out, and they started pulling billions of dollars out of Mexican pesos and putting them into U.S. dollars. And the Mexican peso went from 10 or 11 to 14.4.
If the Mexican peso goes from 10 to the dollar to 14, what does that actually mean?
So let's say so much of Mexico is interlinked with the U.S., that many products are either priced in dollars. In other words, you go to a store, like a laptop store that I visited, and the invoice is literally in dollars, and they do this to protect themselves against the peso devaluing. Or products are imported from the U.S., and therefore their underlying price is in dollars.
So that would mean if the investors are pulling their money out of the Mexican markets and the value of the peso drops and the value of the dollar goes up, everything for the Mexican buyer is more expensive because they pay for it in dollars.
Pretty much everything, except for maybe how much it costs for someone to wait your table. Now, Mexico is a poor country. A large percentage of its population scrapes by, basically right at the edge of extreme poverty. These are people who, when you have a 40% increase in prices, these are people who were okay, who suddenly can't eat, who suddenly can't send their kids to school, who suddenly can't spend money in a store, and so stores start to close, who were fine on the morning of October 10th and are desperate on the afternoon of October 10th. That's what a devaluation means for everyday people.
We just talked about how strong some of these Mexican corporations were and how the government has been fiscally very responsible. Aren't they able to infuse cash into the banks and companies the way the United States government has been in order to protect these people?
Yeah. Well, that's definitely not the role of Mexican companies. So let's put them aside for a second. But let's talk about what the Mexican government did on October 10th when they saw that things were in desperate straits. What they did is, because it had been fiscally responsible, they've basically been collecting a big emergency reserve. It's like a little rainy day fund. And it had tens of billions of dollars in it. And what they did is they unlocked the piggy bank and poured billions of dollars into the currency markets. They started buying pesos. And what they did is there was a sudden surge in demand for pesos because the Mexican government was selling its savings in dollars to buy pesos, and that stabilized things. And so by the end of the day on October 10th, the currency, which had gotten all the way up to 14.4, was in the 13s. And what that means is they stabilized the devaluation, and they got those really jittery currency markets to chill out a little bit.
So you're not seeing food lines, and people aren't in dire straits as they could have been.
Some people in some sectors are in dire straits, but really the message from all of this is that in a single day, due to no fault of their own, Mexico's economy took a major blow. And that major blow has ripple effects.
Now, I assume this is the same case in other emerging markets like Brazil and Russia. And so isn't this happening in a lot of places?
This story is playing out in pretty much every major emerging market. But Mexico is different. And its main difference is the extent to which it's interlinked with the U.S. economy.
When you talk to people on the street, I'm wondering if there was any frustration expressed that they had to be kind of the vulnerable recipients of this American crisis. Did it seem unfair to them, or were they angry at all at the U.S.?
This was one of the biggest questions that I went down to Mexico to find out. Because if I were in their position, I would be so upset. I would be so angry. I'd be furious at my neighbors for totally messing up my economy. And so I asked every single Mexican I met about this. And I was only able to kind of needle one so much that he finally admitted, yes, yes, I'm really, really annoyed by this. I think Mexicans are by nature a very optimistic people. And frankly, there are people who are used to being beaten down. I spoke to a woman who is in her 40s, and she told me that she has never lived through a period of her life in which there hasn't been an economic crisis in Mexico. Mexicans are extraordinarily versatile and able to weather this kind of thing in a way that would be the envy of Americans. They've had a lot of practice.
Dan Gretsch, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Well, thanks for the time, Peggy.
Dan Gretsch is a reporter for Marketplace, a show produced by American Public Media.
We didn't ask Dan if he had tried local chocolate when he was in Mexico, but it wouldn't surprise us if he had. Mexico is the birthplace of chocolate. The story goes that a Mayan god presented his people with a gift from the Garden of Paradise, the cacao tree from which chocolate is made. Nowhere in Mexico is chocolate held in higher esteem than in Oaxaca. They say that every man, woman, and child in this southern Mexico city consumes chocolate at least once a day. Reporter Mary Stuckey turned to Pilar Cabrera, a well-known Mexican chef, to learn the secret of making chocolate atole. That's a special kind of Mexican hot chocolate. We join them on Mina Street, where the air is rich with the smell of chocolate.
We're at Chocolate Mayordomo, one of the very first chocolate stores to open in Oaxaca. We're buying the raw ingredients for chocolate atole, perhaps the most popular form of hot chocolate in Mexico.
And here we stop in the first place and start the business of chocolate in Oaxaca, Chocolate Mayordomo. Here we have in front of us have cacao, cinnamon, almonds, and sugar. I prefer more proportion of almonds and less sugar. This is the flavor I learned from my grandmom. Me puedes vender media molienda de...
Okay, so she is putting these cacao beans, oh, like big coffee beans really, on an old-fashioned scale and weighing them in a big metal dish. After we buy the ingredients, we cross the street to where the grinders are. About half a dozen work in one huge shop whose doors are open to the busy street. Ancient grinding machines pulverize the cacao beans, almonds, sugar, and cinnamon. And then men mix the ingredients into a paste by hand using a knife. Now, even though we have the chocolate paste flavored with almond, cinnamon, and sugar, we're not going to make our own chocolate atole today. Instead, we'll take a short taxi ride to the market to join in a morning ritual in Oaxaca. This market is right next door to the school Pilar attended as a child.
We come into the market almost every day. Yeah, and for me, my best place is Comedor Mari. They prepare the best chocolate we have here in the city. We call chocolate atole. Doña Mari, venimos a visitarla.
Pilar greets the proprietor, Maria Ramirez Vasquez. The 70-year-old, wearing an apron and long braids, stands in front of a huge pot. Inside, dried corn is boiling in water. This is the corn atole, the base ingredient in the hot chocolate drink.
People cook the corn, dry corn, one day in advance. And this water, thick atole, because boiling and boiling, and at the end combined with the chocolate, without almonds, and a lot of cinnamon.
but there's a special way in which the thick corn and the chocolate are combined.
And use the molinillo to bring foamy on the top of the chocolate.
The molinillo is a foot-long wooden whisk. It's a lot of work to use it. There's no milk in this drink, but even without it, Maria whips up a substantial foam. The foam is said to contain the energy of the person who made the drink. That person must be a woman, whose worth as a cook is determined by how much foam she can create. Maria tells Pilar she makes 30 liters of chocolate atole every day to sell in the market. That's a lot of whisking.
At the end, serve in a big bowl with a wooden spoon. We stir the mixture, and then we're drinking, and I feel the delicious flavor of the chocolate, and the combination with the corn atole is great. Do you want to try it?
Nothing like our hot chocolate. It's completely different. This isn't so sweet. Yeah. And no milk in this.
No milk. Doña Marie. Nos vemos.
Time to go. Chocolate atole is a breakfast drink, and the morning is passing. As we leave, we spot two schoolgirls, heads bent over huge bowls of Doña Maria's hot chocolate.
Bebe chocolate cada día?
Sí.
The girls say they start each day with a bowl of chocolate atole, just like countless generations before them. For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey in Oaxaca, Mexico.
They say in Oaxaca, hot water with chocolate. They say in Oaxaca, hot water with chocolate. They say at the fiesta, the burning of lights will tell. They say at the fiesta, the burning of lights will tell. What is your kind of promise? What kind of spell? What is your kind of promise? For soledad, what kind of spell?
Closer to home, if you're looking for some comfort food in these tough economic times, you could try The Same Cafe. That's a restaurant in Denver. That's a little unusual. There are no prices on the menu. Customers are simply asked to contribute what they can. If you've only got a dollar, that's okay. Or if you want to pay extra to cover the expenses for those who can't, that's fine too. You can even pay for your lunch by working off your bill in the kitchen. Does it work? We asked reporter Eric Whitney.
It's the middle of the day, and The Same Cafe is busy. Customers sit at tables bathed in sunshine from big street front windows or chat with cooks who stretch pizza dough in the open kitchen behind the glass front counter. Carl Neufelder stopped by on his way to visit Denver Zoo. It's his first time here, and he says the food will probably bring him back.
Oh, this is great. I mean, I enjoyed the pizza because it seems like it's whole wheat pizza, and you very rarely ever see that in a pizza joint.
The restaurant is a passion for co-owners Brad and Libby Berkey, a married couple in their early 30s.
We love food. We do. We are foodies. If we only had one channel on TV, it could be the Food Network, and that'd be all right with us.
About 5 years ago, Libby and her husband decided that in order to be happy, they needed to share their spirit with others. Brad quit his steady job as a computer consultant, and they opened a restaurant. Brad says they already had some experience cooking for others.
We've been volunteering in different soup kitchens and shelters for about 8 years.
They loved feeding people in need, Brad says, but weren't exactly inspired by what soup kitchens fed them. Mostly it was whatever could be made cheaply and in huge quantities, with little regard for flavor or nutrition.
We wanted there to be a healthier option for people because so many of the folks that we were dealing with and talking to that were staying and eating in these places hadn't had a fresh fruit or vegetable in 6 months or longer.
So Brad and Libby decided that their restaurant was only going to serve the freshest food possible from local growers. It was going to be creative and delicious, and they'd charge whatever people could afford. If all you have is some loose change, or even nothing at all, that's okay. You can order and be served just like anybody else. They called it the Same Cafe because SAME is an acronym for the spirit they founded it on, so all may eat.
I usually sweep and mop the floor for Brad, and Janice does the tables.
Patrick and Janice, who live on the street, often trade work for food. That's the case for about a quarter of the people who eat here. Janice says she can get at least one free meal nearly every day at a church or shelter, but she prefers the Same Cafe.
The people that come in here, they seem a little bit cleaner and more respectable. You know, the soup's always good. I think they do an excellent job.
The Same Cafe isn't just for the poor or the homeless. It gets a good bit of traffic from people who work at nearby businesses. Enough of them pay enough for their meals to generally cover costs. And costs are low because the menu's pretty limited, and Brad is the cafe's only paid employee. Most work is done by volunteers. Libby says the result is exactly what they hope to create, a community based around food where people from all walks of life can relax and get to know each other.
When I look at everybody, I try to, you know, treat them the exact same way and treat them how I would want to be treated. And, you know, most of the time, people who are in need or experiencing poverty are invisible to the rest of us. And this is a space where they're no longer invisible. They have a name and they have a story and they are important.
The cafe has had its ups and downs. Sometimes Libby and Brad have to have a chat with a customer who's taking advantage of them. And Brad says he's not making nearly what he made at his old computer job, but there's no way he'd ever go back.
It's such a feel-good thing to know that you are doing something that's benefiting and helping somebody like these folks over here that just moved into an apartment for the first time in a long time, rather than having to live on the street or in motels. It's a big deal. And you get to hear these success stories, and it just, you know, keeps you going for weeks and weeks and months.
The Same Cafe just celebrated its second anniversary and has served more than 17,000 meals. It's managed not only to survive, but just expanded, doubling the size of its dining room. For the World Vision Report, I'm Eric Whitney in Denver.
I'm sorry, you want the Italian soup and pizza?
Zimbabwe has been known across Africa for its outstanding education system, but now it's falling apart. We'll hear that story just ahead on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. When Zimbabwe became independent in 1980, President Robert Mugabe launched an ambitious education program. The effort was so successful that Zimbabwe achieved the highest adult literacy rate on the African continent. But now, critics of Mugabe's government are saying he's destroying what could have been his most enduring legacy. Zimbabwe's premier education system is disintegrating, along with the economy. Tendai Maposa has this report.
Charles Mbandarikwa has been a grade school teacher in Harare for the past 18 years. But this year, he says, he has only been to work a total of 2 months. At a teacher's union office downtown, he explains why.
Firstly, the salary that we are getting is inadequate. Besides it being inadequate, it's also inaccessible because you cannot get it from the bank. The amount they give per day is actually only enough to cover transport costs.
That is, the daily withdrawal limit from banks is so low, it's only enough for the commute to and from the bank. With current inflation at more than 230 million%, most Zimbabweans are struggling to cope. And Mbandarikwa is not alone. All across Zimbabwe, teachers aren't teaching. In addition to the poor pay, Mbandarikwa says conditions started to decline when the government cut support to schools.
Things really began to become bad around 2002. That's when standards really started falling and the government stopped doing some of the things that they were doing, like giving stationery in schools and everything.
The government expected the parents to step in where it had pulled out. Parents now had to maintain school buildings and furniture. But with the economy collapsing, the parents just didn't have the money. 10-year-old Takura has spent months at home this year because his teacher hasn't been showing up. I met with him at his grandparents' on a day he was supposed to be at school. Instead, he was watching a soccer match on television.
Bazana, good effort.
When he does go to school, he says there is nothing much to do.
The headmaster says, go to the playground and play.
The headmaster says, go to the playground and play until 1 o'clock, then locks the gates. We go home at 1 o'clock.
The headmaster locks the kids in so they do not end up wandering outside the school grounds. He has little choice since there are no teachers to oversee them. Takura's teacher won't talk on tape, but she cited the poor salary and working conditions for staying at home. Like a lot of other teachers who no longer go to school, she conducts private lessons at her home for the children whose parents can pay. She says that earns her more money than what the government pays her. The situation is so bad that the United Nations Agency for Children, UNICEF, has expressed concern. Tsitsi Singizi is UNICEF communications officer in Harare.
Trends are indicating that at least 40% of the teachers are attending lessons, and the exam system is in disarray. It's in a total disarray. It seems as if the sector is tottering on the brink of collapse, and as UNICEF, we're really worried.
While private schools have always existed in Zimbabwe, they are now mushrooming everywhere. But they only cater to the children of the well-off, those who can afford to pay in US dollars. That excludes the vast majority of children here. 28 years after he pushed to get Zimbabwe's people educated, President Mugabe is now being blamed for the problems facing the public schools. And it's not just the opposition that is critical. Like most Zimbabweans, 10-year-old Takura is following the talks between President Mugabe and Morgan Tsvangirai, the leader of the opposition. Tsvangirai is slated to be the country's prime minister if the two sides can agree upon a power-sharing deal. Most people believe a new government will bring change for the better, but negotiations are deadlocked over the allocation of cabinet posts. Takura blames President Mugabe for the stalemate.
It's the president's fault because the prime minister is...
It's the president's fault because the prime minister is given ministries like the Ministry of Sport and the Ministry of Leisure, but the president is taking the Ministry of Education and the Ministry of the Army.
Meanwhile, a lot of teachers have left for neighboring countries or Britain, but school teacher Charles Mbwandarikwa says he is going nowhere. For now, he gets by like most Zimbabweans today, buying and selling whatever is in demand and is unavailable in the shops.
I would say I believe it's going to be all right one day. And I want to make sure that we are there. Because some of us, we love this profession so much. Yeah, I believe we can still do it here. Yes, I want to make the difference here. The difference can be made.
But he admits that even if the politicians resolve their differences, Zimbabwe will need the help of the international community for its education system to recover. And to get the education system to anywhere near what it used to be, he adds, will take a very long time. For the World Vision Report, I am Tendai Maposa in Harare, Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe's President Mugabe was returned to power earlier this year in an election widely regarded as a sham. Elections last week in Ghana were very different. That's the subject of this week's Globe at a Glance. While all eyes are on Barack Obama's transition to the presidency, another historic transition has taken place quietly and without much fanfare. It happened in the West African country of Ghana. Opposition leader John Atta Mills became president last week. He won a narrow runoff election in the closest vote in the country's history. Tensions ran high, and many feared that a close vote would spark violence, like it did in Kenya last year. But after Mills' razor-thin victory, the outgoing president called for calm and cooperation. For many, it's evidence that Ghana has become a beacon of democracy on the volatile African continent. And that's our Globe at a Glance. Every so often, we check in with folks around the world to see what's happening in their lives and their communities. Today, we talked to Busi Dlamini from Johannesburg, South Africa. Busi and some friends started a book club a couple of years ago. That wouldn't be out of the ordinary here in the U.S., but it's a new trend in South Africa. Busi's book club focuses on literature written by African women. She told me about one of her favorite books.
It's a book written by a Nigerian woman who's actually very young. In fact, she puts us all to shame. We all wish we could write as beautifully as her, called Half of a Yellow Sun, written by Amamanda Ngozi Adichie.
Half of a Yellow Sun?
Yes.
What is it about that book that you all have liked?
I think it's mostly her writing style. What's been interesting, I mean, we've been now doing the book club probably almost for 2 years, just over a year and a half. And over the 2 years, what's been challenging is a lot of the stories that are written are rather serious, you know, if not bordering on depressing in some cases. People writing about real experiences that are challenging. And I feel like she's managed to do that in a way that captures the African spirit, you know, in a way that speaks to the light-heartedness of people. So despite whatever adversity people are going through, I feel like for the most part, people are smiling, people are just human. So I feel like she managed to tap into that just a little bit. You know, there's a lot of humor in between just real-life hardship.
Busi, it's unusual to have a book club in your part of the world. There's a high rate of illiteracy, but your book club has been pretty popular with your group of friends. What is the draw?
I think that there's just a change that's taking place in the country, and I do think there's starting to be more book clubs. I was relating to a friend that I think every sort of commercial radio station, you know, has now a book club component to it. So even if it's sort of a 30-minute slot once a week where they discuss books. So I feel like it's starting to pick up and the interest is picking up.
Mm. And what are you reading now?
We've just finished a book called So Long a Letter. So that was our last discussion. It was written by a woman from Senegal, I think in the 1960s. And some of the things that, you know, they discuss are just so similar to the hardships that we're going through in South Africa, the gender issue in particular.
Can you give me a close to the ground example of how that might be fleshed out in a book like this?
Okay, so the book itself deals with a woman who is educated in the 60s, which is also not very common, you know, in Africa, but also then in Senegal at the time, in West Africa. She's educated, gets married to a doctor, and they married for 30 years or so happily. And then I think in their 50s, the husband decides he wants to take a younger second wife. Mm. And traditionally, in terms of Muslim culture in West Africa, that's acceptable. So her own personal struggle around how does she balance, you know, what culturally is acceptable, but emotionally is not for herself.
Do any of your friends have to deal with things like that, with their husbands of 30 years taking on a second younger wife?
We are a bit of a younger generation. It's the interesting thing. I think out of maybe the 18 women that are part of the book club, I think maybe 5 or 6 of us are in sort of committed relationships.
So I'd be interested in knowing what the women in your group say about a topic like this. I mean, what do you think now about a situation where it might be okay to take on a second wife after 30 years of marriage? I would assume you all are kind of aghast at that. Maybe not.
Exactly. Like, I think that's the thing, to think we live in a society where that happens, right, in South Africa, because there are examples of that. But how all of us, you know, with no doubt, everyone was just like, it's not acceptable. So it raised a lot of questions around how we perceive our own culture here, and how we contribute to changing that if we feel like it's not serving us in a positive way. But that's a conversation that's happening constantly in South Africa. So it's interesting when you read it from someone else's point of view.
Okay, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Peggy.
That was Busi Dlamini in South Africa. Here now is a reading from the book Busi mentioned. It's called Half of a Yellow Sun. The author is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. It's set during the Nigerian Civil War, which took place from 1967 to 1970. The war started when the region of Biafra broke away from Nigeria to form an independent state. The university professor at the center of this book is a passionate supporter of Biafra's independence. In this reading, a young boy from a rural Biafran village is brought to work at the home of the professor in a dusty university town. The boy had never been away from his village. Everything was new and strange to him, especially when his new master sent him off to the kitchen to get something to eat.
Ugwu entered the kitchen cautiously, placing one foot slowly after the other. When he saw the white thing, almost as tall as he was, he knew it was the fridge. His auntie had told him about it. A cold barn, she had said, that kept food from going bad. He opened it and gasped as the cool air rushed into his face. Oranges, bread, beer, soft drinks, many things in packets and cans, were arranged on different levels, and on the topmost, a roasted, shimmering chicken, whole but for a leg. Ugwu reached out and touched the chicken. The fridge breathed heavily in his ears. He touched the chicken again and licked his finger before he yanked the other leg off, eating it until he had only the cracked, sucked pieces of bones left in his hand. Next, he broke off some bread, a chunk that he would have been excited to share with his siblings if a relative had visited and brought it as a gift. He ate quickly before Master could come in and change his mind. He had finished eating and was standing by the sink, trying to remember what his auntie had told him about opening it to have water gush out like a spring when Master walked in. He had put on a print shirt and a pair of trousers. His toes, which peeked through leather slippers, seemed feminine, perhaps because they were so clean. They belonged to feet that always wore shoes. "What is it?" Master asked. "Sir?" Ugwu gestured to the sink. Master came over and turned the metal tap. "You should look around the house and put your bag in the first room on the corridor. I'm going for a walk to clear my head." "Yes, sir." Ugwu watched him leave through the back door. He was not tall. His walk was brisk, energetic, and he looked like the man who held the wrestling record in Ugwu's village. Ugwu turned off the tap, turned it on again, then off, on and off, and on and off, until he was laughing at the magic of the running water and the chicken and bread that lay balmy in his stomach. He went past the living room and into the corridor. There were books piled on the shelves and tables in the three bedrooms, and on the sink and cabinets in the bathroom, stacked from floor to ceiling in the study, and in the store, old journals were stacked next to crates of Coke and cartons of Premier beer. Some of the books were placed face down, open, as though Master had not yet finished reading them, but had hastily gone on to another. Ugwu tried to read the titles, but most were too long, too difficult. Non-Parametric Methods, An African Survey, The Great Chain of Being, The Norman Impact Upon England. He walked on tiptoe from room to room because his feet felt dirty, and as he did so, he grew increasingly determined to please Master, to stay in this house of meat and cool floors.
That was a reading from the novel Half of a Yellow Sun. It's by Nigerian author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. The book is very popular in Nigeria, and so is this song. You're listening to the song Kinda Life. It's on the Nigerian pop charts, and it's performed by the artist Nice. Nice was raised in a polygamous home of 5 wives and 9 children. He managed to make it as far as law school in Lagos, but dropped out to try and make it as a singer. Nice had a pretty good year last year. He performed at Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday party in London, and he was named Revelation of the Year. That means Best New Artist at the Hip Hop World Awards.
omo jomo lo la digu mbo ko jomo eniyo tan peri ta pare ni ka so pare ni ajana ku ko jamo ri nkan bi se si imi si olorun lohun mi who was stop me I never see baba dada soke ni gba igba beni ibi pelebe lo ma fi lele mi.
That's it for this week. You can find out more about the show on our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can download a podcast there, and you can read blogs from our reporters all around the world. You can also post your comments. We're always interested in feedback about the show. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Cynthia Graber and Christina Darden are our producers. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Our interactive editor is Larry Short, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for joining us.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.